From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. The chief glory of every people arises from its authors. These are words attributed to Samuel Johnson, the 18th century writer and lexicographer. Turned upon himself, Johnson's words reflect a complicated thinker about whose life and literary output there are various popularly held inaccurate or false impressions. This, according to one scholar and one recent visitor at the National Humanities Center, Donald Green of the University of Southern California and John Vance of the University of Georgia. According to Donald Green and John Vance, conceptions of Samuel Johnson as literary dictator, rigid neoclassical critic, and writer lacking in imagination are inaccurate and misleading. Donald Green is the author and editor of books and articles about Samuel Johnson. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Donald Green worked on a forthcoming literary biography covering the last 20 years of Johnson's life, up to the time of his death in 1784. John Vance is the author of Samuel Johnson and the Sense of History, published in 1984, and he's the editor of a new collection of critical essays entitled Boswell's Life of Johnson, New Questions, New Answers. Don Green, John Vance, let's talk about Samuel Johnson. Don, let me begin with you. Why does he deserve our continuing attention? What is there there that engages you?
Very simply, because he is a very great writer and a very great thinker.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I've always stressed, in fact, my first book was about this, was Johnson's political thinking. Contrary to the myths that float around, he was one of the most advanced, I suppose you would call him, liberals of his time.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the great opponents of Negro slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Put it very simply, he said the whole idea of slavery is so obnoxious, so preposterous, mm-hmm. that nobody could entertain it.
Uh-huh.
Boswell was always arguing with him on the other side to the effect, well, slavery is legitimated by the Bible. They have slaves there. God approves of it. And in fact, it would be very wicked to deprive the owners of the slaves of their property.
Mm-hmm.
And to which Johnson said, just poo-poo.
Mm-hmm.
No decent person can tolerate the idea of one individual being enslaved by another.
How, John Vance, tell me, how did the politicians of Samuel Johnson's own time, and that's a little slippery, I suppose we're talking here around the middle of the 18th century, how did they react to his political thinking?
Well, it's very interesting. Let me just backtrack for a second.
Sure.
In regard to the Seven Years' War and British colonial expansion, this is something that, of course, history books say Britons were very proud of. Being Americans, of course, we know the effects of that colonial expansion. Johnson, however, as Donald Green has just pointed out, was opposed to much of this. He questioned his own government. He questioned the enthusiasm to near hysteria of his contemporaries for the Seven Years' War and for colonial expansion in other parts of the globe. Now, of course, all of this is old hat to us who have seen what has happened to the British Empire, and we have seen Gandhi and other such treatments, passage to India. We're aware of that aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it amazes me to hear students discuss Johnson as somehow a spokesman of the conservative / Tory cause.
Uh-huh.
Of his country, as if he went along with whatever the government proposed. And in fact, often Johnson was at odds, not a government spokesman, but a critic of the government.
Mm-hmm. John Vance, Don Green, we've been talking about Samuel Johnson's politics, his sense of history in the past. Let's talk about Samuel Johnson as a literary force and influence. It goes without saying that he is influential. That's easy for me to say. Now, what I want you to do is tell me how that works. How does he come to us in the 1980s? Don Green, you're working on a biography. You're looking at, you've spent many years looking at Johnson's writing. How about that?
I'm not so sure that as a writer, he was particularly influential on people who followed him as, uh-huh. as writers. There is this old story about Johnson, the literary dictator of his time. That is nonsense. In fact, some of his friends point out that Johnson was very reluctant to pass judgment on some work that had recently been published. I'm unfortunately in the position of trying to write a biography of his later years after he got his pension, when he was not quite as prolific as he had been before, for obvious reasons. Nevertheless, in those last 20 years of his life, he turned out a great deal. His major political pamphlets, for instance, in the 1770s. And then the so-called Lives of the Poets. I say so-called because this was a title given to them later. They were actually prefaces, biographical and critical, to an anthology of the works of something like 50 poets of his century.
Are these worth reading today?
Oh, are they ever?
Why?
Some of the greatest criticism ever ever written, and I could quote people like Edmund Wilson and F.R. Leavis and so on to to that effect.
Give me a specific example, an insight that that Johnson provides, for instance, about one of Shakespeare's plays.
You're very good. I'm glad you asked that, because I have one right at the tip of my tongue that I'm very fond of. At the end of each of Shakespeare's plays, he has sometimes a few paragraphs, sometimes quite a number, describing his own reaction to them. And I'm very fond of the one on Julius Caesar, where he begins by saying something like, this play has been much admired, and especially the quarrel between Brutus and Cassius in the last act has been greatly praised. But I have never been strongly agitated by it, and think it somewhat cold and unaffecting. Having studied Julius Caesar, I think, in the 10th grade, I was delighted to find that that was precisely my reaction at the time. I didn't dare say it, of course, to my teachers.
So Johnson teaches us that it's all right to be, a bit of a free thinker, a bit unorthodox in our literary reactions.
Oh, it's the only way to to be. Something else, I think, in his Life of Pope, he says Pope has been sometimes criticized because his verse is too musical. But Johnson goes on to say, this is the verdict of those who judge by principles, not perception. And he is obviously in favor of judging by perception rather than by principles that have been laid down beforehand.
John Vance, let me ask you to follow what Don Green has just said about Johnson's literary, well, I hesitate to use the word theory if he's not so much devoted to principles as he is impressions. Is he what you would call a highbrow? Don Green referred to Johnson's literary greatness. He's a genius. He's a high thinker. Does that mean that he belongs in some sort of pantheon that puts him apart from the popular audience today?
Well, I think that's the most interesting question whenever I think of Johnson and Johnson's reputation. Perhaps of all authors in any literature, Johnson has, in the minds of people who have really never read him, such a firm sense of what he is, what he was. Now, how does one arrive at that sense of Johnson, not having read most of his works? Yes, they dip into a work like The Lives of the Poets and, say, his criticism of John Milton. This is the interesting thing. Johnson, those who have come to Johnson, and not just specialists, but those who have read Johnson are 18th century specialists, I think we're all quite amazed that Johnson is so much contemporary, that he does speak to us, that we can see him as one of us. Now, I know that Don Green will have something to say about the influence of Boswell's Life of Johnson. I can say here, I think that is a major reason why Johnson's image is as it is. I think Johnson is much easier to teach as a stereotypical figure, as the great literary arbiter, as the one who talked the best literature, the one who pronounced and destroyed careers. All this is nonsense. But it's easier to talk of Johnson, and then breaking from Johnson was the great romantic revolution.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid as teachers of literature, we rely too heavily on the compartmentalized, the stereotype, one period is a reaction against another. And Johnson fits so well in that, as we can. Johnson was struggling hard,
right,
as neoclassicism was ebbing. Uh-huh. Johnson was trying to hold it back.
It's easy to put him into that. Into
indeed,
that
it is.
Don Green?
And it saves you the trouble of actually having to get down and read what the man wrote. This is the occupational disease of teachers of literature generally.
Uh-huh.
Put him away somewhere, give him a label, and then we can forget about
mm-hmm.
him. Going back to your question about his being a highbrow, I would say emphatically, yes, he was. In fact, I have an article coming out in the South Atlantic Quarterly in a little while entitled The Great Highbrow. And I am there quoting the critic F.R. Leavis, uh-huh. who said Johnson, through the influence of Boswell and so on, is regarded as the great club man.
Uh-huh.
And you can hear Leavis sneering while he says that. He was not. He was the great highbrow. But then most famous writers and writers who deserve their fame have been highbrows, like T.S. Eliot, for instance, mm-hmm. or E.M. Forster, or William Shakespeare, for that matter. Mm-hmm. When you get Shakespearean scholars plumbing the depths of illusion and imagery and so on in Shakespeare, it could be more highbrow. No, Johnson is writing for the intelligent, common reader.
Mm-hmm. Don Green is engaged in the writing of a biography of the later years of Samuel Johnson. I want to ask you about the enterprise of literary biography, but let me begin by putting two words on the table here. James Boswell. I understand you have some quarrels to pick with this man. Tell me about that, Don.
Well, primarily because he's a liar. perhaps unconscious.
Uh-huh.
But
why, for instance, would he have done this? Why would you characterize him that way?
Well, in writing the life of Johnson, he certainly wanted to make a name for himself, and he also wanted to make money. He uh-huh. was practically broke by the time he finished the manuscript of the life. And the negotiations that he went through to finance his life for the last mm-hmm. year before it is finished are quite interesting.
Well, Don Green, just generalize for me on a scale of 1 to 10, how much of the material that one would read in Boswell's life of Johnson is reliable? A good bit, not much?
It wouldn't be possible to give an honest answer to that question mm-hmm. before a great deal of very close work is done on this. Mm-hmm. At the moment, I have a list of about 10 or 12 famous sayings of Johnson which are not substantiated mm-hmm. by the entries in the journal. May I quote one?
Certainly.
Be of interest to our audience, I wonder. There's a famous story about the wife of one of Johnson's friends, Lady Diana Beauclerc, her name was, who had been divorced by her first husband because of adultery with her the man she did marry, Topham Beauclerc, one of Johnson's best friends. And Boswell, in the life, reports an argument with Johnson about Lady Diana's virtue, in which Boswell reports Johnson as saying, "The woman's a whore, and there is an end on it." That is one of the most memorable things attributed to Johnson, and it has turned more of my students and acquaintances off Johnson than any other alleged remark of mm-hmm. his. If you look at the journal for the time, and this is noted by the great Boswell scholars, F.A. Pottle and his predecessor, Geoffrey Scott, what you find is a note telling very vaguely about some kind of argument that Johnson, Boswell, and others had about Lady Diana's morality, at the end of which Boswell quotes Johnson as saying to Boswell, "Go to Scotland, go to Scotland. I never heard you talk so foolishly." to which Professor Pottle, the great expert on Boswell, comments, this is a very bold substitution by Boswell mm-hmm. in the life, which it certainly is. Mm-hmm. But I'm just starting to look at some of these, and there's a lot more work to be done on it.
John Vance?
Having heard Donald Green on Boswell, I would trust that at least a good number of our listeners might be sitting back in a great deal of shock and surprise. My goodness.
We can't believe this?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Is not a Johnsonian also a Boswellian? Mm-hmm. This is an interesting aspect of Johnsonian studies, the relationship between Johnson and Boswell and how much the life of Johnson should be used in research. We have an edition coming out of new essays and a couple of major older essays, including one by Don Green, this fall, the University of Georgia Press, which attempts to deal with some of these issues.
The volume is edited by John Vance, incidentally.
Thank you very much.
Fair enough.
Give some of the other side. Boswell's life is seen by many as a labor of love, and Don can respond more directly to these.
In respect toward Johnson?
That's right. Uh-huh. Johnson was a man that Boswell loved dearly mm-hmm. and wanted to revere his memory, mm-hmm. although there are other ulterior motives could also be part of that. That the life, for occasional inaccuracy and error, does give us at least a good, strong sense of Johnson, that the quotations of Johnson's in the life, although maybe a word or two may not be accurate, the gist is accurate. Johnson did say at least something like the woman's a whore and there's an end on it at mm-hmm. that time. This is another view. That the life of Johnson is such a rewarding reading because it is literary art. Uh-huh. It is a literary work, and there are several newer critics who are discussing the life of Johnson as a piece of literature. Mm-hmm. Johnson as a literary hero, for instance.
Almost as a novel.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly right. The life of Johnson, whether we like it or not, is going to play a major role in anyone's perception of Johnson who is not a specialist. And as teachers of Johnson, we need to be very careful in how we assign the life of Johnson.
Now, you're talking about Boswell's life.
Boswell's life of Johnson,
right.
Yes, regardless of how we look at Boswell's life, either as a marvelous work, which, with a few inaccuracies, still is the major source of Johnson, or whether or not we see it more Don's way, mm-hmm. that the life of Johnson is a very dangerous work in our knowledge of Johnson, because students will normally go, or teachers will normally have them read Boswell's life first, and I think that may be a mistake. Mm-hmm. I think they ought to get to know Johnson first.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about the life and work of Samuel Johnson, the 18th century English writer and lexicographer. The Soundings panelists are Donald Green of the University of Southern California and John Vance of the University of Georgia. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Donald Green worked on a forthcoming literary biography about Samuel Johnson that focuses on the last 20 years of Johnson's life, up to the time of his death in 1784. John Vance is the author and editor of books and articles about Johnson's use of history and about James Boswell's life of Johnson. This edition of Soundings is part two in a series of conversations about notable figures in 18th century English literary history. Well, let me follow up what John Vance has been saying about Boswell's life of Johnson, put a question to Don Green. If there an uncharitable way of characterizing your attitude, Don, might say, well, you're nitpicking, for crying out loud, just these minor details. Go to the other end of the spectrum. What large impressions would one come away from Boswell with that need to be corrected? Is the enterprise, from your standpoint, mainly a correction of many minor errors, or are there really large misconceptions in that?
Well, I think it's a large misconception to think of Johnson's being important primarily as a personality as uh-huh. he emerges from Boswell, and not as the great writer that he was.
You mean the raconteur, mm-hmm. as opposed to the thinker who writes?
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. The person who says a woman's a whore and there's the end of it. The point being, that in the last 22 years of Johnson's life, Boswell and Johnson were in each other's company only, apart from the trip to Scotland, which I'll say something about later if you want me to, a total of 225 days, which averages out to 10 days a year. And Boswell, people seem to forget, lived in Edinburgh, not London, where Johnson did, and came down to London only every other year or something like that.
So here's more evidence, not necessarily to rely too heavily on Boswell.
The point being, as I have said, and what I'm trying to do in this third volume, is to find out what Johnson was doing in the other 7,500 days of those 22 years, of which Boswell gives very little account. Mm-hmm. He couldn't because he wasn't around.
Mm-hmm. John Vance, let me ask you to follow what Don Green has said. You have Don Green sitting right here next to you. You may want to avoid my question. What are we likely to learn from a biography like this? What does this matter to, obviously it will have a specialized appeal to an academic audience. What might a general reader come away from another biographical effort about Johnson with?
Well, I think the reader will learn a great deal from Don's biography. There are details in any individual's life that may have more significance than you might think. Minor details, minor comings and goings. We need, I think, to break Johnson away in those last 21 years from the Boswellian picture.
Mm-hmm.
That is, Johnson always in company, Johnson always at the head of the table, pounding out his pronouncements on any given topic.
Right.
Now, it's not to say that that's all Boswell gives us. I don't mean to say that. But in a biography, as I think Don will write, we're going to see Johnson somewhat apart from that. Boswell will have his rightful place as one of Johnson's friends and infrequent companion who comes down every so often from Edinburgh, a man to whom Johnson corresponded, but not he wasn't the major correspondent. We will see other of Johnson's friends assume their important position, names that most general readers have no knowledge of. But that's closer to the truth, and that's the most important thing. I think a biography like Don's will get us to the truth of Johnson. One aspect of Johnson I don't think is as appreciated as it ought to be, or the emphasis is not as it ought to be, is Johnson's sense of humor, his enjoyment of life. Now, in regard to that, Walter Jackson Bate has a very fine chapter on Johnson's sense of humor. But I think the emphasis is that Johnson's sense of humor was an escape from the oppressive demons that were after him.
Rather than an integral part of his...
Well, Bate argues that it is integral, but it's more or less an escape. Frequently, you will get the impression, and if you talk to colleagues in your field, that Johnson was always as strong as a man as he was. He was always being forced by something else, whether it was Boswell pushing him toward confrontation or this escape from the psychological problems, to respond humorously. We have Johnson, unfortunately, as a caricature of a man laughing like a rhinoceros, as one of his contemporaries said. This is Johnson bellowing out, ha, ha, ha. But I think his sense of humor goes far beyond that. Johnson, and this is a point I make in an essay for this Boswell collection, that Johnson has a very elusive sense of humor. Johnson is adept at manipulating others, of setting others up, not being set up himself, and using his humor to orchestrate these interesting little scenarios in which he plays a role himself. So instead of Boswell or anyone else setting Johnson up, as so many people believe, Johnson was much more in command of the situation, and through his sense of humor. And this, and unfortunately, my final point here, is that so many of the quotations in Boswell's life, and this may not just be Boswell's fault, but they come off the page as being comments literally to be interpreted, when they could honestly be tongue-in-cheek. They could be said with a smile. They could be said with a straight face, but meant to be humorous. And yet they're documented. I would ask anyone to consider if someone ran around behind us with a tape recorder and recorded everything we said on any given day and printed it, how might we respond to that? A lot of people would take us the wrong way. And I think in Johnson's case, we have to keep that in mind.
John Vance, Don Green, let's conclude our conversation about Samuel Johnson. Give me a brief answer, each of you. What would you have a general audience know about this man by way of correcting a misconception, simply by communicating a notion that that you cherish about Samuel Johnson? Don, can I begin with you?
Yes, I'd answer it in much the same way that I answered a similar question at the beginning of this conversation. I'd say they should go and read some of Johnson.
Uh-huh. Know his work.
Know his work. Mm-hmm. And whatever their tastes in reading, there's a fine variety in Johnson. We were talking about this a while ago, and I had the pleasure of being introduced to Johnson on the recommendation of a teacher of mine when I was an undergraduate by reading The Idler, which was a weekly column in a newspaper, a short column, which is sometimes at least as funny as Art Buchwald and Russell Baker, and sometimes very serious indeed when he denounces the way that Europeans treated the native populations in the Americas. Mm-hmm. Very readable it is. And if they were interested in that, as I think the average intelligent modern reader would, they might well be tempted to go on to his Rambler papers, which are a little more serious, and many other things.
Thank you. John, Vance?
I would hope that anybody who reads Johnson, as Don Green has suggested, will see that instead of being a literary dictator, or one that one cannot approach, Johnson was a great humanitarian. Hmm. We've touched on some of these aspects, Johnson's abhorrence for slavery. Mm-hmm. Regardless of comments such as "the woman's a whore and there's an end on it," Johnson was very encouraging to women, mm-hmm. as opposed to being chauvinistic in the modern terminology. He had once advised Fanny Burney, who was a little bit sensitive about going to Elizabeth Montagu, one of the great blue stockings, he advised her, "Always fly at the eagle." Hmm. Always fly at the eagle. And this is not a man who wished women to remain in a subordinate position. Mm-hmm. Johnson respected the work of women authors, mm-hmm. but he evaluated people as they were. Mm-hmm. He responded to them as they were. Johnson was had a very acute mind in regard to human behavior. And I think, if you read his works carefully, that aspect of Johnson will come out.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the second segment in a series of conversations about notable figures in 18th century English literary history. The topic was Samuel Johnson, the writer and lexicographer who lived from 1709 till 1784. The Soundings panelists were Donald Green of the University of Southern California and John Vance of the University of Georgia, both of whom have written books and articles about the life and work of Samuel Johnson. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, Donald Green worked on a forthcoming literary biography that covers the last 20 years of the life of Samuel Johnson. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Samuel Johnson, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, conversations about the English poets William Blake and William Wordsworth. The Soundings panelists will be Morris Eaves of the University of New Mexico and David Simpson of the University of Colorado. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for a discussion about Samuel Johnson, the 18th century English writer and lexicographer. Upon Johnson's complicated literary life rests a burden of popularly held misconceptions: the literary dictator, the rigid neoclassical critic, the unimaginative writer. Why are these notions misleading? Some answers and insights from Donald Green of the University of Southern California and John Vance of the University of Georgia. The life and work of Samuel Johnson this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.